Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, the Perseid meteor shower and tips for seeing it. And the global weirdness of climate change. Here's a scientist soundbite.
This is the event of the year for meteor watchers in the Northern Hemisphere. It's really nice on a summer night when you can just lie outside on a reclining lawn chair and watch meteors. So this is the time to do that.
That's sky watcher Deborah Bird. More with her later, but first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
The United Kingdom has had its fair share of stormy weather this summer. June 2012 was the wettest period ever recorded for the United Kingdom since record-keeping began in 1900. Meanwhile, England and Wales each tied with the year 1860 as the wettest June since their records began in 1766. Although there has been somewhat of a lull in the stormy activity across London and the 2012 Summer Olympic Games this past week, a new area of low pressure will likely bring more unsettled weather across the UK this week.
NASA's Curiosity rover is a one-ton robot about the mass of an SUV that will make an unprecedented Mars landing at 10:31 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time on August 5th. That's 5:31 UTC on August 6th. NASA produced a stunning video depicting the series of events involved in Curiosity's entering the Martian atmosphere and landing. The risky maneuver will keep rover team members in suspense for seven fateful minutes, what they're calling 7 minutes of terror. Check out the amazing video at earthsky.org.
New research helps explain why we sneeze, what sneezing should accomplish, and what happens when sneezing does not work properly. The research, published online in July in the FASEB Journal, suggests that sneezing is the body's natural reboot. Researchers likened it to Microsoft Windows' infamous blue screen of death, and that patients with disorders of the nose, such as sinusitis, can't reboot, explaining why they sneeze more often than others.
Over the past 50 years, Earth's oceans, forests, and other terrestrial ecosystems have absorbed a substantial amount of the carbon emitted by human activities, according to a new study published online on August 1st in the journal Nature. The new study did not detect any significant declines in carbon uptake over the past 50 years. In fact, the study found that, globally, the amount of carbon uptake on Earth doubled from 2.5 to 5.0 billion tons per year between the years 1960 and 2010. Still, no one expects the uptake of carbon by oceans, forests, and other natural ecosystems to continue indefinitely. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. This week's Song of the Week is Back to the Way I Was by Emily Bell.
But I'm still here and I will not go quietly into the
We're Earth Sky. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Share your pictures of the Earth and the sky with close to 100,000 fans. You can find us on Facebook as Earth Sky. Deborah Bird joins us now with news of the global night sky, the peak of a meteor shower coming up. Welcome, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. Well, this is the event of the year for meteor watchers in the Northern Hemisphere. And one reason the shower is so great from the Northern Hemisphere is just that it's nice and warm outside at this time of year. And so, you know, when you're out there watching meteors, you can wrap yourself up in a sleeping bag and put, you know, a bunch of blankets on top of you. But it's really nice on a summer night when you can just lie outside on a reclining lawn chair and watch meteors. So this is the time to do that.
Great time to take it easy, go outside and catch some easy meteors. What are people looking for, Deborah?
Well, the Perseid meteor shower is the one that peaks every year in August. And this year, the peak of the Perseid shower is going to, it always happens in the early morning hours. So this year, the early morning of the 11th, the 12th, and the 13th are the best mornings to watch. So those are the mornings when the meteors will be, you know, at their peak. You see the most meteors on those mornings. But the Perseids, all meteor showers are different. And the Perseids happen to be a shower that rise very gradually to a peak. So in the week or so leading up to the peak, you're also going to see meteors. Now, there's one caveat this year, and that is the moon. The moon is in the way. So the full moon is in early August, and that means that the moon is going to be in the morning sky, that midnight to dawn sky that is so great for meteor watching. But as the month passes, and as we get closer to the 11th, 12th, 13th, the moon is going to be waning, so there's going to be less and less moon in the sky. It's going to be in the sky fewer hours of the night. So many people say they see meteors in bright moonlight. It's not impossible. In fact, we're hearing from people already who are seeing meteors streaking along in the light of the moon. But watch for the moon and mark your calendar for the mornings, not the evenings, of the 11th, 12th, and 13th to watch the Perseid meteor shower.
And those hours, when I've tried to look out for meteors, I'm a little groggy. Do you have any tips maybe for people who, maybe these are first-time meteor watchers out there? Any tips for when is like the best time? Do we have links at earthsky.org?
Yeah, we absolutely have a lot of information at earthsky.org. So if you come to earthsky.org and you search for the words meteor shower, you're going to find a whole bunch of different posts about it. So that's a cool thing. But, you know, meteor watching, I think, is so popular because it's so easy to do. I mean, you literally, all you have to do is find a sky that's wide open. You don't want to be obscured by buildings or trees or anything like that. You want to take a lawn chair or a blanket even will work, something you can lie down on the ground and just look up. And so in recent years, people have gotten this idea that there's a particular place in the sky that you have to look to see meteors. That's not true. The meteors are going to appear all over the sky. So you don't have to have any knowledge of the stars or constellations to see a meteor shower.
Right. But if you're an extremely observant sky watcher, you might notice that as you follow those trails, they seem to come from a particular point, right?
That's right. If you trace the paths of the meteors backwards, you'll notice that they're all coming from a single point in the sky. And that point in the sky happens to be the constellation Perseus. So that's how the Perseid meteor shower got its name. And meteor showers are named from the constellations from which they appear to radiate. But you don't need to know the constellation Perseus. You don't even need to know what part of the sky Perseus is in. In fact, the best meteors don't even become visible until they're maybe, you know, 20 or 30 degrees away from what's called their radiant point, the point in that constellation that they appear to radiate from. So you definitely don't need to know the constellation Perseus. You don't need to look in any particular direction in the sky. It is kind of helpful because no one person can see the whole sky at once to bring along a buddy, a meteor watching buddy, and then you can put your lawn chairs sort of opposite each other, so you're each looking at an opposite side of the sky. And then when someone sees a meteor, they can say meteor, and then the other person can turn around and see it too. So that way you'll maximize the part of the sky that you can cover with just your eyes. And by the way, you don't need any special equipment for this either. You don't want binoculars, you don't want a telescope. You want to be looking with just your eyes, and that way you'll see the beautiful streak across the night sky that we know as a meteor or shooting star.
Yeah, and I guess sky watchers need to know that this is one of the big meteor showers for this year in August, peaking the 11th, the 12th, the 13th of August, early in the morning.
That's right, those mornings. And yes, the other meteor shower that's about as good as the Perseids is the Geminid meteor shower. That's a summertime shower for the Southern Hemisphere. So that's a good shower for the Northern Hemisphere as well. But then you have to drag out the sleeping bag and the blankets and the, you know, hot coffee and all that stuff to stay warm while you're watching for meteors. So Perseid meteor shower coming up.
Awesome. And more tips at earthsky.org.
That's right.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. What do scientists really know about climate change? And what do they predict is likely to happen if the world continues with business as usual? Science writer Michael Lemonick is with Climate Central, an independent nonprofit journalism and research foundation that does scientific research on climate change and informs the public of key findings. Lemonick has co-authored the book Global Weirdness, and he's on the line now to talk more about it. Mr. Lemonick, welcome.
Thanks very much.
What message do you want to get across to people in your book, Global Weirdness?
The message I want to get across in Global Weirdness is a pretty simple one. It's that climate scientists have a wide array of evidence that shows pretty clearly that the Earth is warming up, that the weather and the climate are changing in unpredictable ways, and that human greenhouse gas emissions, mostly from burning fossil fuels, are a very major cause.
What are scientists saying about some of the unusual weather-related events happening in 2012? For instance, record drought in the U.S. There's record ice melt in Greenland. And make this connection for us, like you just said, this connection to human activities like burning fossil fuels and deforestation.
Okay, well, in 2012, we've seen a lot of unusual weather, a lot of drought, as you say, unusually severe heat waves. We've had a number of very severe torrential rainstorms, especially in the U.S. Other parts of the world are experiencing different kinds of unusual weather. We had a warm winter in much of the U.S., but Europe had a very, very cold winter. And so we're seeing that the weather, on short-term scales, is unusual. Unusual weather happens. It's part of life, and it has been forever. But what we seem to be seeing is an uptick in these kinds of events, and especially we're seeing many more high-temperature records being set than low-temperature records. In an unchanging world, you'd see about the same of each every year or every decade, and we're now moving to a period where we are setting many, many more high-temperature records than low-temperature records. We see things like spring arriving earlier, in the U.S. by about 2 weeks. Snow is melting earlier in the western mountains. There are really dozens and dozens of indicators showing that the planet is warming up, and the evidence comes directly from the atmosphere. We can look at it, see the greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere. We know there's more of it than there was when we started burning fossil fuels about 200 years ago, and we can actually measure a chemical signature in the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that shows that that's just where it came from. So it's a lot of evidence pointing to exactly the same conclusion.
Yeah, in the book Global Weirdness, you talk about some of these changes that are happening. Loss of Arctic sea ice, the spruce bark beetle, they've invaded Alaska and are devastating trees there. Mr. Lemonick, what would you say is the one thing, maybe, on scientists' minds as they consider climate change?
It's hard to pick a single consequence of climate change that they're most worried about because there are so many. One big one is sea level rise. So as the ocean warms up, it actually expands. So sea level rises for that reason. But even more important, the ice in Greenland mostly, also to some degree in Antarctica, is starting to melt And it's also starting to slide into the sea faster than it's done historically. And both all of those things together are making sea level rise. We've seen about 8 inches on average of sea level rise since the late 1800s, and we're expecting to see another 2 to 6 feet by the end of this century. And so we've got millions and millions of people in the U.S. and many millions, tens and hundreds of millions around the world in cities like Shanghai and Amsterdam, Calcutta, built on the sea that are now in danger of rising seas that are threatening to flood hundreds of millions of people out. So that is a huge danger. Another huge thing people are worried about is permanent changes in weather patterns that will make the Midwestern U.S. much drier. So you see this drought this summer that is devastating crops in Illinois and Ohio and Indiana. That could become a much more common and maybe even more or less permanent condition toward the end of the century and beyond, which means that all of the agricultural infrastructure, all the food the world depends on here and in other parts of the world, is suddenly going to be in a place where it's unsuitable for growing these crops. And so all of those farms and all of the highways that transport the food and all of that infrastructure is going to be in the wrong place, just as the cities are suddenly going to be in the wrong place. But I think what worries scientists the most, if I have to name one thing, is that while all of these changes are on the way, we could be doing something about it today, and we're not.
Was there anything hopeful in your research on climate change in putting together this book, Global Weirdness? Was there anything hopeful in thinking about the future risks of climate change worldwide?
Well, I mean, the hopeful thing, and the good news is that we actually have the technology today to start dealing with climate change and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions significantly right away. The problem is that it will take a real commitment to do so and to roll out renewable technologies like solar and wind and biofuels, which are beginning to emerge, but require a lot more research before we can figure out the best and cleanest burning biofuels. But all of this is proceeding too slowly to make a big dent quickly in our emissions. And so the technology is there. That's hopeful. Another technological cause for hope is that if we can't manage to limit our greenhouse emissions, there could be technological ways to actually limit the damage. So people are talking about something called geoengineering, which would find ways to keep less sunlight from reaching the Earth and warming it up by injecting particles of sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere, kind of blocking out some of the sun. That's quite a risky possibility because we don't know yet what all the side effects of that might be, and they could be serious. Another thing that people are working on is some kind of technology that could actually pull carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere once it's there. That's in very, very early stages of development, so it's nothing we can count on yet. But I was just talking to a climate scientist this morning who works on these geoengineering issues, and he said, you know, I'm confident, you know, when we have a real crisis facing us that we can't avoid, we have a way of advancing dramatically in our technology in a very short time. And he pointed to World War II. We entered World War II. The U.S. still had horse-drawn artillery and biplanes. And within 4 or 5 years, we had radar, and we had jet planes, and we had the atomic bomb, which is a mixed blessing. But we made fantastic progress in a very short time once it really penetrated people that we had to do it.
You've been listening to science writer Michael Leminick. We're at Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much art, and not backstage.